Regardless of where you are in your homesteading journey, whether you are just starting out or you've been at it for a while, there is no way that any of us can know absolutely everything when it comes under the homesteading umbrella. And this is where it is key that you are learning from people who have life experience and have been doing this homesteading when it comes to livestock in the kitchen, but they have been doing it for a long time so that you can bypass the mistakes that they have made along the way. And getting it delivered in your mailbox, in your hands every single month from some of the most trusted voices in homesteading is exactly what you need. And Homestead Living now has Homesteading Monthly, which is an in-print monthly magazine featuring articles from Joel Salatin, myself, Carolyn Thomas, as well as homesteaders who you may not have heard from them, but they have been perfecting their craft and are very much an expert in their area. You can get this for less than $2 an issue. Yes, that is an in-print jam-packed with articles every single month. Go to homesteadliving.com and grab your subscription right now.
Hey, Pioneers, and welcome to episode number 308. Today, we're talking about maximizing your homestead for profit and production. So we're going to be talking about ways to manage your property to increase the amount of livestock and or garden. It may not be livestock, but maybe it's produce that you're growing. And we're going to be talking about it in a way that maybe it's just increasing what you are providing for your own family. But if you are looking to make money from your homestead and sell some of the things that you are growing and or making, you guys, this episode is gold. And it's not, it is on my podcast episode, but the reason I'm telling you that it is gold, because I learned so much from this episode that as soon as I got done with this interview, I immediately sent the link, the unedited link, to my husband because it hadn't even been released yet. And I said, you've got to listen to this episode. He did, and I'm not kidding you. He listened to the episode, and within 2 days, we began implementing a lot of what Joel, yes, that is who we are interviewing today. So if you are, you probably have heard of him. You may not be as familiar with his work, but most folks in the homesteading realm have heard of Joel Salatin from Polyface Farms. He's kind of like the grandfather, so to speak, of the modern homesteading movement, especially within regenerative agriculture practices, permaculture practices with livestock, but also with really spreading the word within larger, without just in the homestead community, is what I'm trying to say. So Joel has been kind of an evangelist as well as a teacher for this way of living for both, like you and I, who are homesteading and doing this or wanting to do this on our properties, but also in outside of the homesteading realm, which has been really amazing. So I have known of Joel for years. In fact, when we first started raising and butchering our own chickens, we watched YouTube videos of Joel showing how to butcher a chicken, and we would play it the night before, the morning of, and this is going to sound funny, but back when we first started, like, our cell phones, we didn't take them out with us like a lot of people will do now, because now with the cell phone that I have, back in the day when we first started raising and butchering chickens, I didn't have a cell phone I could take actually out in the field, or we probably would have had the video playing on our first time that we butchered right there so we could go step by step. So I have known of Joel, and also our chicken tractor is another thing that Joel really, I should say, pioneered and made really popular and people aware of. And so we modeled our movable chicken tractor with both our meat birds and our laying hens after Joel's teachings and all of that. But I had not actually read any of his books. I had never had the privilege of hearing him speak before, besides a podcast episode. I'd listened to a podcast episode that he had done. When my husband and I went to the Homesteaders of America's event, which was in Tennessee. And so if you've listened to any of my past episodes, you're familiar with that. But we got to hear Joel not only teach, and he was also showing a chicken butchering presentation demo. It was a hands-on event. And we were so inspired by so much of what Joel was sharing that on the flight home, we bought on Audible 3 of his books so that we could listen to them, one on the flight home, because from Tennessee to Washington State was a layover. Let me tell you, we had a lot of hours that was sitting either in the airport or in the airplane. And then also we could listen to the books like when my husband was at work at his day job and I was doing stuff, that we could listen to them and then come back together in the evening and talk about what we heard and how we wanted to apply that to what we were doing on our homestead. So when I say Joel is a wealth of knowledge, like literally you probably are going to want to be taking notes. I was taking notes as this interview was going down. I shared the notes with my husband. I shared even some of the other notes about the profit and production as far as a homestead business part with some friends of mine who were members of a small group mastermind. I got on Voxer and I'm like, you guys, I just got done doing this interview. Listen to this. And was sharing a lot of the points that you're going to hear here in just a moment. So this is a phenomenal episode. I hope that you really enjoy it as well as Joel's words of wisdom. Now, for links to any of the stuff that we are going to be talking about, you can head over to my website, melissaknorris.com/308, just the number 308, because this is episode 308, to get resources to a lot of those links. Now, we do talk both about the produce side, but we also talk quite a bit about livestock as well. And speaking of livestock and having wonderful meat that is pasture raised, today's episode is sponsored by ButcherBox. Now, ButcherBox, even though we do raise a lot of our own meat, I signed up with ButcherBox because, one, they contacted me and said, we'd like to send you some of our meat to get your opinion on how it basically like goes up against your own meat to see what you think of the quality and the difference. And if you like it, then to share it with your audience. So I did. And so they sent me a box with a bunch of stuff and we have been going through it. We've done their grass-fed hamburger. We actually did the New York steaks this past weekend and we're very happy with them. And I always say that if you can raise it yourself, that's always the best. But we have layers in life, right? So there's like the top, which is always the best, and then we come down. And so if you can't raise it yourself or buy from a local farmer, then I think ButcherBox is an excellent option. And I have to say that right now, at the time that you are listening to this, you could go to butcherbox.com/pioneering today for a very special deal. So this is a limited time offer to new members. But right now, you can get free bacon for life. So what this means is with every order that you place, if you sign up using butcherbox.com/pioneering today, then you are going to get a free package of bacon, which is from Heritage Bred Pork, a package of uncured, unbelievably delicious bacon added to every single box for the life of your membership. Now, why is that a good deal? We raise our own pigs. So you've heard many of my episodes where I've talked about the different breeds that we've done. We have bacon, but we only have so much bacon per pig, right? So you have the option, we have the option to, once we've went through the bacon that we get from our hog, to either not have bacon again until the next time that we butcher, or to search out bacon and just purchase some bacon from another source. And I'm kind of the belief that life is too short to go without bacon. So when we exhaust our own bacon, then I will be getting my bacon from ButcherBox. But you can get a package of bacon for free by going there right now using the link, which is butcherbox.com/pioneering today. Now, let's dive into this very, very incredible episode with Joel. Well, Joel, thank you so much for coming on the Pioneering Today podcast. I am beyond thrilled to get to chat with you and for our listeners to get to listen into your wisdom as well. And I know there is a plethora of things that you could talk about, but one of the things that we experienced at the Tennessee Homesteaders of America event, where we got to hear you speak, my husband and I both, is we were feeling we were at a place where we thought we really needed to have more acreage, and we were not satisfied with the land that we did have for what we wanted to do with it. We currently raise grass-fed beef cattle, and we do laying hens, and we do meat chickens and pigs on and off. We don't at the moment have any meat chickens or pigs on the farm. And we have about 6 acres that's actual pasture. And then we have another 6 acres that is very heavily wooded and very brushy. And it's a little bit of a swampland. And we're running 6 head of cattle right now, which is about an acre of pasture land per animal. But we're really, it's overgrazed. It's not producing enough for that amount of cattle. So it's either we downgrade our herd, which we don't really want to, we run less cattle, or we thought we need to find more pasture land is where we were at. And then we listened to you, one, talk about regenerative practices, which I would love to pick your brain on at the end. But really what struck us was when you said, don't be land hungry, and I'm paraphrasing slightly, but learn to work with the land that you have. And my husband and I's eyes have been opened to so much of what we could be doing with our land that we're not currently, by just switching our focus and looking at it as a way, like, let's make this work to the best of it and our ability. So I would love for you to share more on that with people, because I think a lot of people are at that point where they think that they need more land to make it work. And we just loved all of your wisdom. So take it away.
Okay. Well, it's a great beginning here, I think. And it's good that people are feeling that, feeling some, you know, some tension in their homesteads, in their small acreages, that they're looking for more. So around here, the phrase that we use is fill it up. You're not ready to move on to more until you've filled up what you have. Now, that's not always the case. I don't want to, you know, be a an obnoxious cultish about this. I mean, if you really like cattle and you're really good at cattle and you want to expand the cattle and you've only got 6 acres, you know, you're going to have to find some more acreage in order to expand your cattle. But the main thing I was trying to get at there was before you do that, before you go to more acreage, think about what you can do to fill up what you have. I mean, when you start brainstorming what you can do to stack in permaculture style, stacking additional enterprises on an existing land base on your 6 acres, you know, you could obviously, you know, it wouldn't detract. In fact, it would simply add more grass to the cattle if you, for example, covered the 6 acres with broiler chickens, for example. Well, you know, you could raise 3,000 broiler chickens on 6 acres. 3,000 broiler chickens, you know, is worth $15 to $20 a piece. You know, you're suddenly up there in the $45,000 range of gross income, not net, but gross. And then you could raise turkeys on that same acreage. You could raise a set of laying hens, you know, maybe 500 to 1,000 laying hens on that acreage. That's that part. And then, of course, you could add honeybees. Honeybees don't—they don't compete with anything. They simply complement what you're already doing. And so you can do that. You can raise rabbits. I mean, so I'm obviously a heavy livestock guy, but you could also take a half acre off and do very, very intensive gardening. I mean, the stuff that Ben Hartman has done with Lean Farm, or Jean Martin with his program there in Quebec, where they earn, you know, a full-time salary off of, like, you know, an acre and a half of high-value produce. Singing Frogs Farm in Petaluma, California. I mean, intensive production where you don't plant seeds, rather you start germination trays in, say, a solarium or a hoop house situation, so that you never put seeds into the garden. You're putting sets plants into the garden. I mean with these little cardboard seed things that you, I don't forget now what the name of them is, but anyway, people are actually transplant. You can transplant beets. You can transplant virtually anything that you would normally think that you wouldn't transplant with this new really sophisticated intensive technology infrastructure. And my encouragement would be to think about how you can stack additional enterprises on there. Then the other thing, of course, is to add processing infrastructure. So rather than doing raw sales, turn everything that you produce into a higher value added product, like meat pot pies, for example, or developing an inspected kitchen. I mean, that wouldn't take, but that's the footprint of a garage, but an inspected kitchen to take your cucumbers to pickles and your chicken to a chicken pot pie, for example, and your carrots to meat pie status, all those things. Suddenly, you're looking at a situation where you can generate, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 per acre. And suddenly land is not your limitation. Your limitation is your own imagination. Our son Daniel says, our problem is not resources. Our problem is constipation of imagination. We just can't imagine all the things that we could do. And then when you have something like that, that's so cool for people to see, then you could have farm tours and you charge people to sit on a hay wagon and take a farm tour. And then you offer them a meal, for $100 a pop, and you bring in a bluegrass band and have an evening of entertainment, and you've suddenly, generated, $5,000 from an evening on the farm with a band and entertainment and homemade food. I mean, those are all things that can be done either by you or by collaborative partners to generate additional income on your small acreage.
Oh my goodness, Joel, that all in itself, unpacking each of those, we could talk for hours, but I love all of the examples and different things that you can give. Now, so we were looking at, I love your suggestions there, at increasing our broiled chicken. So we do the grass-fed beef, like I said, small herd, and the pigs, and those we sell to family and friends. Obviously, it's not a huge volume there. But we were thinking that, goodness, we could do a lot more meat birds. With the size of land that we have, like you said, it's a smaller footprint, and that would also help our pastures. The pastures have been just grazed by cattle, except when we took them over and have run small amounts of chicken over them for well over 70 years and have had nothing done to them. So on one hand, it's good because there's not been, commercial fertilizer or weed killer or anything like that, but it's very compact. It's very weedy. It's just not been cultivated. It's just had the monocrop of the livestock essentially on it, just cattle. So we were thinking, okay, if we increase with the smaller livestock, which would be the chickens, that would give us something, else to do. It would also really help restore the pasture so that we could possibly run more cattle on what we do have, if needed, and just make it better. But I was looking at, and I know this is getting really technical, and each state I know has different laws, et cetera. But so I started to look into that, and we would need to get licensing if we wanted to sell the meat chickens to people. So do you have anything, like, as you're actually digging into like the licensing, and if you're looking to hire people when you're doing that large of a volume, and it's not just, you're you and your spouse in our case, do you have any tips for finding people to help or about that process when you're looking to enlarge, going from just a one or a two person farm, if it's a couple?
Yeah, well, let's take this apart little piece by piece.
Okay.
Interrupt me when I'm off the reservation here. Teresa and I did, several thousand broilers, not 20,000, but we certainly did, five to, 8,000 pretty much ourselves, there early on, and, just two of us. And we had a regimen, but the two of us could process 25 birds an hour. So in in 4 hours. I'm sorry, the two of us could process 50 birds an hour. That's 25 birds per person hour. So in 2 hours, we could do 100 birds. And so in a morning, you know, we would start. I'm just telling you what we did. Mm-hmm. I would get up, set the alarm, get up, go out, start the scalder, go back to bed while the water got hot. And then we'd go out at 5 and we'd process till 7. I caught those 100 birds the evening before and we'd do 100. Then she'd come in, get the kids up and breakfast and all that. I'd go do chores, bring in another 100. We'd start back in at 9, work till 11 and clean up by noon. Customers began arriving, you know, by 1. And by 4 o'clock, all the 200 birds are gone, sold, and 200 times 15 bucks a piece is $3,000. And then I'd go do chores. She'd get supper, and you know that was a day. And we would do this, so we could do 200. And that was a sprint. That was a long day, but we didn't do it. But you know, about 3 days every 3 weeks. So we'd have 2 weeks off. And then we'd process 3 of those days in a week and do, you know, in the neighborhood of 600 birds, you know, in that week. And and we would do that, you know, 8 times in a season. So, you know, you're looking at 4,800, 4,000, 4,000 to 5,000 broilers, just the two of us. So the trick, what I'm getting at there is the trick is A, having good, efficient equipment. You know, automatic scalder, automatic picker, a nice table to work on, you know, good water source. I mean, that's just having some good infrastructure there. And secondly, skill. The weak link in this is skill. The Waterloo for everybody is skill and how to be able to process these birds fast. And so, you know, we were very skilled. And so we were able to do it real fast. So I think, well, it's always more fun with a couple other people, and I encourage that. We've always encouraged folks to come and, you know, to come and process with us and learn. All right, I'm just giving you some numbers so you can see what is doable, what we did, and as my mentor Alan Nation used to say, if somebody has done it, it can be done. So you know that's the way we would go forward with it. Now, that's the kind of the manpower situation that you asked about. So now you get into the licensing and all of that. And so my encouragement there, what state are you in?
I'm in Washington State.
Yeah, Washington State.
Yeah.
So Washington State, yeah. Different states have different, you know, strategies, but there is a federal exemption. It's called Public Law 90-492, PL 90-492. It's the producer-grower exemption. It's a federal exemption. It allows you to do 20,000. It's the producer-grower. So a producer-grower, if you're the producer, the grower, you can do up to 20,000 chickens a year without inspection. Now that doesn't mean that a bureaucrat won't come and visit. It means that no bureaucrat has to be on site while you're processing. And the only thing the law says is that they have to be sanitary and unadulterated. Now that's of course very, very subjective. Now a state can be more restrictive. And if you know my book, Everything I Want to Do Is Illegal, you'll read in there our battles with the bureaucracy over keeping our open air shed legal throughout this process. We're still doing it open air in the backyard. And you know, and we do, well, officially we do 20,000 a year.
Got ya.
So about 30 states have just written in the 20,000, and about 30 states have written in 20,000, about 20 states are more restrictive, some down to the 1,000. And so here's my counsel. My counsel is don't do anything at first. Nobody's going to give you a fine. Nobody's going to send you to jail. There's not going to be a big deal. If you get on the wrong side of a bureaucrat on this, what they'll do is tell you you have to quit. That's the worst that'll happen. And so I encourage people to go ahead and just start. Don't ask, don't tell. Now, don't do a bunch of advertising. Don't advertise it, you know, in the newspaper or anything like that. Just do it as you've done, you know, family, friends, one-on-one, QT, you know, on the quiet, just let it be gentle. We call this guerrilla, you know, guerrilla marketing. And you just let it kind of organically go at its pace as an undercurrent, a quiet grassroots revolution, you know, in the community. And you know, we did this for 15 years before we got sideways of the bureaucracy. Then, of course, we had to deal with that. But most people, if you just remain quiet and just don't advertise and just let it go word of mouth and gently, you know, you'll be able to go 3 or 4 years. And at least that's long enough to find out if you like it. Is it profitable? Is it something you can do? Is it beneficial? Is it a good fit for you? And so by the time that you get crossways of the bureaucracy, you'll figure that out. And if it's not a good fit for you, then, you know, then, well, makes it easy to quit. If the bureaucracy throws too big a hurdle in front of you. But if it is a good fit, then there's a whole list of things that you can do to either circumvent or comply, depending on which is easier. Sometimes circumvention is much easier than compliance. For example, you can sell the chick live to a customer and process it for free. So that way you're not processing chickens. You are offering that's a free service you're not getting paid for. It's the transaction of money that gets you in trouble with the bureaucracy. You can process 100,000 chickens a day in your backyard and give them to neighbors, and it's completely legal. But the second you charge a penny, now it's quote unquote in commerce. And so the government basically does not regulate things that are in charity, but they regulate things that are in commerce. And there are now numerous ways to circumvent that. In fact, in August, we'll be hosting the Rogue Food Conference, R-O-G-U-E, Rogue Food Conference. Our moniker is circumvention, not compliance. And where we bring together the best circumvention ideas and practitioners in the country to share their wisdom and their loopholes for people to be able to, to transact business in their communities in ways that kind of circumvent that, you know, the regulatory, the draconian regulatory oversight. There's a lot of options there. Once you get to that point, but my advice is always just go ahead and start. You know, you can get up to 500, 600, maybe even 1,000 birds. And the worst that'll happen is somebody will say, you know, a bureaucrat will say, you got to stop this. And then that's when you make a decision as to, you know, how you want to proceed going forward.
Gotcha. So if we did where you came in, bought a farm tour and learned how to process a chicken, and then you just got to take the chicken for free, we're not actually selling the butchered meat. Would that be a kind of what you're saying?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, you may not know that Washington State, I think it was Washington State, the Seattle area is where I don't know what the trade name was. It was like backyard butchery or something, but there's now a franchise for an urban meat processing franchise where people come together. It's essentially a pop-up backyard butchery deal where they do pork. I don't think they do chickens or beef, but they do pork. And so, you know, 10, 15 people will get together and pay, you know, $200 for a day-long class in butchery. And so they kill the pig. They come together at somebody's backyard, kill the pig, and cool it down. And then in the afternoon, they cut it up and make sausage and all that stuff. And everybody takes their portion home. And it's a way for a farmer to be able to sell a pig direct market without any regulations whatsoever, even circumvent the entire slaughterhouse, you know, deal. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a, I wish I could remember the name of it right now, but at least several years ago, it was a going concern, an actual franchise deal that was spreading from the Seattle area into, you know, other cities around the country.
Oh, I'll have to look that up. I have it. We're about 2 hours northeast of Seattle. We're much closer to the Canadian border, but that's still relatively close. So I'm sure I can do some searching around and see. That'd be very interesting to look at. My brain is like going 100 miles per hour now with all of the different things that you've said here and ways that we could do that. Now, I do actually have one question. So you were every 3 weeks. So you were obviously just getting, you know, chicks in at varying stages in order to butcher every 3 weeks. But when you guys first started, you said you would do about 200 birds would be in that day, and you would do it over about a 3 day period. So every 3 weeks, was it new customers? Was it just people that would buy, you know, enough birds to just get them through, or was it just a combination? Or I'm just really curious at what the clientele looked like when it was at that smaller point of operation and it was direct to consumer.
Sure. Well, it was all over the board. I mean, we had people who would come a long distance once a year and, you know, and get 50, even 100 chickens. There weren't very many of those, but we still have those today. Who come, you know, even up to 500 miles with a minivan. They take all the seats out of it. Mom and dad take a weekend away, you know, and leave the kids with grandma and come, and basically it's their, you know, it's their pilgrimage to Mecca, and they fill up the freezer for the year. But most people would come and get 10 or 15. was the normal thing. They'd eat a couple of them fresh, put the rest of them in a freezer. Some people took them home and cut them up and parted them out. They had, you know, breasts and thighs and legs and, you know, different things, make stock out of the backs and necks. And, you know, it was the whole gamut. And then, so, I mean, back in our early days, we didn't actually sell frozen, but we only sold fresh birds. You know, I've been at this a long, long time and watched the erosion, if you will, of domestic culinary, skill and participation dwindle over the years. I mean, when we started, you couldn't even buy boneless, skinless breast in the supermarket. I mean, if you wanted boneless, skinless breast, you had to go get a chicken and take a knife and cut it out, and, you know, and all that stuff. Then gradually, you know, pieces and parts started coming up in the supermarket. Gradually, we had more and more customers asking, well, would you do pieces and parts? We didn't want to do it and didn't want to do it. And finally, you know, we just had so many people saying, well, I'd buy more chicken if you do that we decided to offer it. And the first year we offered it, we sold another $20,000 worth of chicken without raising another chicken. That's what value added. That's what value adding does. So we basically take a $15 chicken and we part and piece it out in about three person minutes of labor and double the value of that chicken. So, yeah, so you can, you know, if you start doing all parts and pieces with your 3,000 broilers at $30 a piece because you're part and piecing them out, now suddenly you're up in there, you know, in the $90,000 range.
Oh, my gosh, that is fascinating. I would have never guessed that you could increase the profit just by doing some of that manual labor and selling it by the piece rather than the whole. That is fascinating. From both a business aspect, but also to, you're right, and mainstream. And I'm not, you know, excluding myself from that, because there are times when it is nice to pick something easy and someone else has done part of the work for you. But that is just amazing, those numbers. Wow, I would have never guessed that.
Yeah. Now, Melissa, to be sure, we don't charge our differential in price between, for example, boneless, skinless breast or chicken tenders versus wings, or which are now very in short supply of it, but versus wings or legs or thighs. Our price differential is way, way different than it is in the supermarket, because we're using all hand labor. And so we consider this a luxury convenience in the greater supermarket you know, marketplace. The boneless, skinless breast is considered kind of a staple. And so, so, you know, while our legs and thighs, I can pull a price list right here. Our legs and thighs, might be, you know, $5 a pound. The boneless, skinless breast is, $14 a pound. That's a much wider separation than you'll see in the supermarket. But what we wanted to do on this, we were paranoid. Our biggest fear when we started this was we'd get left with a bunch of, you know, the bottom end of the bird. Mm-hmm. And so we put those, what we wanted to do, we wanted to make the boneless, skinless breast. We wanted to get our value back on the entire chicken, that we could actually throw the whole chicken away, the rest of it away, if all we sold was the breast. That way we covered our risk and you know, made it better. And you know what? That price differential for us has helped keep equilibrium in that inventory, so we aren't throwing away the, you know, the bottom end of the bird.
Oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And honestly, like, I know too, like, obviously, you know, with pasture raised, the way that, and we have modeled the way that we raise our meat birds, even just for our own personal consumption, from you. But, and I'm sure you experienced this too, but I experienced, like, with our meat, like, people like want to compare the price they would get at the grocery store for slaughterhouse meat versus this pasture raised heritage breed, you know, like, done well. But when they taste the difference, then they're like, oh my gosh, like, they get it, because there is no comparison, the texture, the flavor, I mean, let alone the humanity of it for that animal. And so I know, like, if someone's listening and if you've never had true pasture raised poultry and chicken, like, you don't even know what you are missing until you've tried it. And then you're like, oh yeah, it's worth every penny, because it is so much more flavorful and better for you, and obviously better for the environment and the animals involved. But just on a flavor, just on the eating part, so different.
And one other little item I would like to add to that, when you start talking about price pointing, which is, you know, we could do a whole podcast just on price pointing and the messaging around artisanal prices, the art of setting price points, and, you know, prejudicial price points, you know, what can people stand, what can they not, that sort of thing. But we just point out to our people all the time to realize that that our chicken, if you buy a whole chicken, it's cheaper per pound than boneless, skinless breast at Walmart. And that chicken will give you several meals, you know, not just one, from that boneless, skinless breast. So, you know, nutrition, taste, you know, all those things aside, just from a price pointing standpoint, our whole chicken price is roughly the same as boneless, skinless breast from Tyson at Walmart. So, you know, that's an important selling point that we make, you know, in price point.
Oh man, yeah, amen. Same, yeah. I feel like that's not feel like it's true. It is true. Anytime I feel like you're buying the whole thing, like, or even if it's a half a beef or a quarter beef, because you're paying the same price per pound for all of the cuts. And you don't get that when you go to any other, like, a store, Walmart, Costco, whatever it is you go to. So yeah, great. Thank you for pointing that out, because it's very true as well. So Joel, I have to ask you, I know time is precious here, but when we're looking at wanting to do more regenerative practices on our existing pasture that we do have, and chickens are going to be a part of that. But one of the things for our brushy areas, so we have a lot of blackberries, just invasive blackberries, which are actually brought here. A lot of people think they're native. They're not. They were brought here in the 1800s, and that's why they're so invasive. But we also have, predominantly in our forests here, we've got cottonwoods, alders, and maples. And then our evergreens are cedar, fir, and hemlock for the most part. And then we'll have some, like, vine maples and the underbrush, salmon berries, et cetera. So for our forested area, because we don't want to take away all of the forest and turn that all into pasture, but we would like to get more use out of that land. And so we are looking at considering either sheep and or goats. And I have no experience with either of those from a livestock or as a dairy animal. All of our experience lies in chickens, cattle, and pigs. So do you have any advice as to when you're looking at bringing on either of those parts of livestock as to things to consider when you're choosing between them?
Well, yeah, I do actually. First of all, I would say that, I mean, you've got to remember that sheep and goats are very different. They both have a much broader palatability index than a cow. In other words, they'll eat more thorny and briary and, you know, different things than a cow. The main difference between a goat and a sheep, a goat is a grazer like a cow, and a goat is a browser, and wants to eat 70% of its intake above its shoulders, whereas a sheep is a grazer like a cow and wants to eat 70% below its shoulders. Mm-hmm. So if you're trying to clear out, you know, brambles and brush and things like that, there's no better tool to do it than a goat. Just remember that a goat is a lot more difficult to keep in. You know, the old saying, if a fence won't hold water, it won't hold a goat. And so a goat's difficult to get in. But here's the silver lining. You know, everything has a silver lining. The silver lining of a goat is that because they eat above their shoulders predominantly, you don't have to move them as frequently as you would a sheep or a cow to keep them from grazing over their own defecation. The reason you have to move a sheep and a cow so frequently, I mean, we move them daily, there are a lot of reasons for that, but one reason is because they're grazing over their own excrement. Whereas a goat, because they're browsing, they're not down there nibbling, you know, and running their lips across where they just pooped yesterday. And so while the fencing requirement is more on a goat, you can leave a goat in a place, goodness, you know, a week, and move them weekly and be fine. Now, the other thing to remember as you think about this is that the recovery period on brushy, woody vegetation, the energy recovery period, in other words, it's defoliated, and then it has a recovery period where it uses its own internal energy to, you know, to send out new shoots and buds and leaves. The recovery period is way, way longer on woody species than it is on forage species, legumes, grasses, medics, forbs, all those, the forages. And so that's why goats tend to transition a brushy, weedy place from brushy stuff to grass over time, because they gradually kill the brushy material and aren't that aggressive at grazing the grass. So the grass tends to come up under the defoliated brush, which tends to gradually die over time, because most people don't give it enough recovery, don't want to give it enough recovery to actually completely recover its energy cycle. So the general trajectory is the brushy stuff goes downhill, and descends in vibrancy on a given landscape, and the grasses, the grazing, the sheep and the cow preference, the grasses then tend to come on. That sounds like a very nice landscape trajectory for someone who wants to bring on forages. Here's the problem. It takes about 5 years for that to happen. And at about the 5-year level is about the time you start to really like the goats. You know, you learn how to keep them in, you learn how to, you know, move them and take care of them, all the different things. You just start learning about goats. And so at the 5-year level, just when you've fallen in love with your goats is right when they've eaten themselves out of their habitat. Then you turn them into grazers, and now they're eating over their manure. They're eating candy bar forage when what they want is a lot of roughage and cellulitic material. And suddenly then you get prolapsed uteruses, you get mastitis, you get hoof problems, all sorts of things, because we've taken this browsing animal that wants to eat more rough stuff, more fibrous, less protein, and turned it into a lush candy bar, you know, forage grazer like a sheep or a cow. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, those are just some things to keep in mind on these systems, you know, depending on the acreage and your own energy level, sometimes these things are you know, in the big picture, just as easy to convert with a, you know, with a chainsaw and a matic. Obviously you can run pigs in there, but the pigs won't, they'll take brush down if you put their feeder on them. So you can get pigs to mash over and kill brambles and brush if you put their feeder or water on the spot. We've done a lot of that where you just keep moving that feeder and water around each time the pigs access a given lot. You continue to move those pigs, the pig infrastructure around, and create high impact zones where that infrastructure is. And you get this bramble patch one time, you get that bramble patch the next time, and before you know it, you've got nice grass and clover and plantain where there used to be, you know, blackberries and multiflora roses, and the pigs have done all the work. The pigs will not climb up something like goats. You know, they won't climb up, push things down, but they do have a very, very broad palatability index. And so just don't discount what pigs can do over time, especially if you help them a little bit with the mattock and a chainsaw from time to time and even a machete, and just kind of come in there as a partner to the pigs and be their partner.
Yeah, we've had great success actually with the pigs helping clear. I think part of our problem is we either need to bring on more pigs in order to get more of it cleared how we would like. And I think that's why we were kind of looking at the goats for some of those brushy areas. But maybe it is bringing in more pigs and finding, you know, more of a market for the pigs, or just enriching our customer base with the pigs. And doing that, because they did an excellent job. In fact, it was so funny. My husband was just out there this past weekend. We butchered the pigs we butchered them the end of January, and then reseeded that area because they had gotten it down to the dirt. And so we reseeded it, and he's like, man, in comparison to the rest of the pasture, like, I can't believe how rich, like, the clover and the grass, like, everything in that area, it's just prime. Like, it looks so good. But I think for us, it's figuring out how to be able to do that we want it on a faster scale, I guess is what I'm getting at there. Which does lead me to my next question that I've got for you. And so that is, where we have the pasture that doesn't have any brush on it, which is great, but it's where the cows have been predominantly, but it's very compact and it doesn't have a lot of clover, a lot of grass. Like, it's just not prime. It hasn't been. Is there a time when you would say, if you really needed to get turned over and loosened up and you want to grow more clover, that you would just disc that up and do it manually like that with a tractor and reseed it and keep the cattle off of that for a time? Or are you always a proponent of, no, see if you can do that with other livestock instead and take the longer route?
All right. So Melissa, I've got a question for you. Yeah. Are you rotating these cows? Are they on this 6-acre pasture all the time? Is it divided in half? What's your management style?
Great. Yeah, it's divided in half. And so on the top half is where I have my laying heads, which is only a flock of 9 right now. So we're moving them across it. And then we're rotating the cattle about every, right now, in order to get it grown up enough to feed the 6 as we move the herd, we're keeping them off for about 2 to 3 weeks and then putting them back on. And so we have it rotated into thirds. And so every 3 weeks they're going from one to the another. So are because it's not growing fast enough, unfortunately, to feed them all if we don't let it go that long.
Okay. All right. So, here's what I'm going to suggest. This is what we do.
Yeah.
And so I want you to think about this.
Okay.
Imagine putting those 6 on a spot that would feed them for only one day. Only one day.
Okay.
And you move them every day. And what happens then is that they don't re-bite the new growth. You can walk out there where they are and you can look. Get down on your hands and knees if you need to, But you can look at the new shoots. You can see the grazed grass sheath, the outer sheath, and then the grass sends up a new whorl in the middle of that sheath as it sends up its new blade, and the cattle will graze that off even when that new shoot is only an inch tall. Andre Voisin called this the law of the second bite. And the problem with that is that it weakens the grass plant because the grass plant can't get beyond its slow restart, you know, what I call diaper grass stage. It can't get into, you know, juvenile adolescent stage where it grows very, very rapidly. So by confining them tighter to 1 or 2 days, the grass cannot regrow enough for them to eat the regrowth before the grass has produced the energy, has replaced the energy it used in sending forth that shoot. See, the plant actually uses up its carbohydrate savings account stored in the root to send forth that new shoot. And if you don't let that leaf area, the solar collector, if you don't let that solar collector get big enough, long enough, and strong enough to replace that savings account in the roots that was expended in sending forth the shoot, you actually weaken that plant over time. And so what you're doing, the reason pastures wear out is because they're not being allowed to rest long enough between the initial pruning, mm-hmm. and the second pruning. Sometimes, excuse me, sometimes I like to use the word pruning instead of grazing, partly because grazing has such a negative, you know, politically incorrect connotation these days. But secondly, because pruning actually connotes a lot better what we're striving for. We're actually not trying to use up, i.e. graze, use up the forage. We're actually trying to prune it to restart a freshened up vegetative production cycle. And so I can't tell you sitting right here, I don't know what your rainfall is. I don't know what your fertility is. I can't tell you if 6 on 6 acres is too many. My mm-hmm. sense is it probably is. But you know, here on our farm, we're running 0.9 acres per cow equivalent, okay? We're getting 400 cow days per acre. And so I know that 6 can, you know, in some places, mm-hmm. 6 can be run on 6 acres, but you're going to have to really, really tighten up that grazing where they never eat that second, that new shoot. What happens then is that you have, instead of three paddocks that you rotate every 2 to 3 weeks, instead what you have is, well, let's say we've got, just for sake of discussion, let's say we've got 6 acres, and if we want to go to, let's say we want to go to 60 day rest periods, just for sake of discussion, that means you would have 60 paddocks. That would be a tenth of an acre per day, a tenth of an acre per day, for those 6 head. Now, if you had, so what does a tenth of an acre look like? Well, a tenth of an acre, you know, if an acre is 5,000, roughly 5,000 square yards, a tenth of an acre looks like 500 square yards. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, what does that look like? Well, 500 square yards would be like 20 yards by 25 yards. Okay. Just to give you a sense of it. And so as you go to that, you essentially create a mosaic, you know, been grazed, regrowing, yet to graze. You get this extreme patchwork quilt view of your pasture as you go that direction. And and it's quite profound. But that's the only way that I know, the only way I know that you can get maximum production without sacrificing gain. Okay. And there will be some times when you sacrifice gain to do that, because individual performance and acreage performance are on two opposite ends of a teeter-totter. To get maximum gain, you need to reduce your intake, your production per acre, so they only eat cream. Problem is, if they only eat cream, then they're going to gradually clean out all the good stuff, and they're going to eat all the good stuff, and they won't eat any of the bad stuff. You want them to eat, you know, weeds and everything. Okay, and so by restricting them, that's the only way I know that you can get maximum production and maximum per acre. And what that will do is move. The bottom line is that kind of management style will move your species diversity to a totally different place. So I never recommend planting a seed. You've got all the seeds you ever need right there in the pasture. Some of them have been there for 100 years and they're waiting for management to change so they feel comfortable germinating and will live. And they're just waiting. So the rule, so our axiom here is change the management, change the vegetation. So whatever you have is a physical manifestation of the management that's been applied to that acreage for, you know, X number of years. And it can go back, you know, to long before you were there too. That enters into that context. So the faster you can get it to a primal movement choreography, think about the wildebeest on the Serengeti, think about the bison on the American plains. The faster you can get it to that mob effect, tight rotation, the faster you'll start seeing these other species begin to develop, and you'll get a lot more organic matter, more fertility, better. I'm sure they have campsites, so they tend to have spots that they drop manure in, spots that they eat, and so you get this real translocation of nutrients, incubator for pathogens, campsites, that sort of thing. So by going to the smaller patches, you make sure that you put all your manure and urine right on the forage that they ate, and it tightens up your fertility program as well. And you're not translocating nutrients to under other places.
Okay, goodness, that was a wealth of information, and I am so excited. In fact, before this episode even releases to the listeners in public, I'm having my husband listen to this one. There's so much good information in there. And you know, like the actual growth pattern of the grass, like you were saying that they were eating that new, like I did not even know that. I have not studied the growth of grass like I have our vegetables and our fruits and our berries and that type of stuff. So I thank you so much for explaining that to me in a way that I could understand, but also in a way that's like, this is going to be your best practice. Really appreciate that.
I can't help but do a shameless plug here. I have a new book coming out in August called Homestead Animal Happiness. And it has a whole chapter, you know, explaining what I just explained to you. What I'm trying to do is miniaturize and downscale all the principles we use at commercial scale, downscale it to a 2 to 10 acre homestead capacity, and put in all the things that I have not seen in homestead livestock books. So stay tuned, that's coming.
Yeah, and as soon as it comes out, I will be sharing it with my audience. We, on our way home from the Tennessee event of the Homesteaders Americas Conference, we got 3 of your books and put them on Audible, and so that my husband and I could listen to them together and then come back in the evenings. He works a day job, and go over the stuff together that we've listened to. And we've already been so inspired to do so many things. So yes, your books are really great resources. And thank you so much for coming on today, Joel. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Melissa.
Was that not an incredible episode or what? And we have already begun implementing. We've got the pasture divided out and we have started rotating the cattle through the exact process that Joel shared in this interview. And I have to say, my husband and I were both shocked
to see it worked exactly as Joel said. Now, I should say we've only been rotating them through. We're only into day three. But when we put them in the very small paddock for the first day and had that sectioned off per his recommendations, you guys, they ate weeds and small little things of brush that were just starting to come up in that area that they would never have touched previously. So by putting them in, just like he said, they definitely went after and ate down the weeds as well. So we are really, really excited to see how our pasture is going to evolve and improve by using these methods. And of course, the longer we do it, the better that's going to be and the more apparent it's going to become. But right off the bat, we're very, very excited to see how that was coming. Now, we've also already begun implementing some of his strategies and marketing advice with raising chickens for meat, which we've already done for ourselves for years. But in looking at offering that as actually a profit center for our homestead, where we can offer that to community members. Now, if diving into business, turning your homestead, or maybe it's a skill set that you have, or maybe it's even a product that you have, but learning how to turn that into a business, specifically with marketing and using online avenues in order to be able to market and to find your customers and then to sell effectively to those customers, then I have partnered with Ann of All Trades, who is a dear friend of mine, who is also a very, very savvy online marketer herself within the traditional skill set. She does carpentry, if you're not familiar with Ann, as well as a bunch of other homestead things. And we are doing a free challenge. I'm very, very excited about this because I've never actually done I've done business consulting is actually business consulting / coaching privately with friends and acquaintances, but I've never done it in this type of a public before, and getting to do it with Anne. So you're getting two of us with both of our experiences. We are doing it completely for free during this amazing 3-day challenge. So during this 3-day challenge, you're going to discover your product hook in order to nail your marketing and get targeted customers that buy. That is the key there, targeted customers that buy. You're going to learn how to find the right customers to increase your sales organically with free resources that everyone has access to during this free 3-day challenge. So it's starting on Tuesday, June 22nd with myself and Ann of All Trades. So you need to go and get your seat, get registered at melissaknorris.com/business. melissaknorris.com/business. I cannot wait to begin talking about all of these things and sharing everything that both Anna and I have learned over the past decade in order to grow our businesses so that you can create streams of income for yourself and your family using your homestead skills and or possibly your homestead. So go and snag that seat right now. And I will meet you back here next week for another amazing episode. I really do hope that you found Joel just as delightful and his knowledge base as wonderful as I did. Blessings and mason jars for now. Mm-hmm.